Okay, it's time again for our little soiree. There'll probably be one, maybe two more podcasts on this topic since it's a pretty big topic and I have a lot to say about it in terms of various aspects involving it. As I mentioned in the previous podcast, it's a pretty big area and the evidence involving the prevalence of this disorder has certainly not decreased any in recent years. The pattern certainly changes over time in terms of the use pattern and what's fashionable and what's not, but in terms of drugs being less popular now than they were 15 or 20 years ago, that's definitely not the case. It's just the format and use patterns have changed. One thing I wanted to finish up, which I started last time, and I realized in hindsight that I didn't finish my story on Ivan Pavlov. I talked about classical conditioning and how the psychological aspects of the addiction, which is the layperson's term for substance dependency, which is the clinical term. I'll be using the two interchangeably. Pavlov's experiments with canine gastrointestinal and salivary scenarios were what got him the Nobel Peace Prize. He's the author, obviously, of this thing called classical conditioning, which is the psychological principle that ties two seemingly unrelated events together and is the source of most phobic disorders, so-called irrational fears, which fall under the anxiety rubric, as well as a lot of substance use abuse disorders, which is the psychological aspect of them and why they're really hard to quit. And I talked about how Ivan Pavlov came to fame initially, which was not for his psychological use, but for his work with dogs, canines, gastrointestinal juices, and various aspects of them. And his claim to fame was being able to install a cannula tube, which is that needle that goes into the dog's salivary gland that collects saliva for these experiments he was running. I didn't finish that. The thing is not that he could put the cannula tube in the dog's mouth, but that he could do it with the dog unmedicated or unanesthetized, knocked out or whatever, and the dog not yelping and screaming and biting his arm off. That was his claim to fame. He could insert the cannula tube with the dog fully conscious and awake with, you know, little to no anesthesia, and I don't know how the heck he did it. I don't know all the particulars, but that's the story behind it. And I didn't quite finish the story last time, so I wanted to finish that. I felt compulsively guilty about not doing that, which of course I would because of my tendencies to be perfectionistic. But that's another story and probably end of the podcast. At any rate, where I left off last time was talking about some of the basic paradigms of substance use and abuse disorders and the difference between use and abuse and abuse and dependency, which I talked about and outlined last time. So if you missed that and you want to go catch up on that one, go back and review the last podcast on that topic. I went over the famous Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, fourth edition, which is the current, as I like to refer to it, Bible of Shrinkdom that we're using to diagnose and categorize so-called mental disorders in this country. What most people may or may not be aware of is the DSM is an American invention. What most other countries use is a thing called the International Diagnostic Classification System. And supposedly with this new healthcare stuff, which frankly, I don't keep up with because I think all of it's a bunch of crock of you-know-what, but, you know, I don't want to get into politics here or, you know, public policy because that's not what this podcast is about. But suffice to say that I think politics need to keep their dirty hands out of our business in general, but particularly driving diagnoses and what's fashionable and what's to be used and what's not to be used. But according to the new healthcare regulations, I think in 2014, you're supposed to start using only the ICD classifications when reporting insurance reimbursement stuff. That's a whole nother territory for those of you who aren't familiar with that. And the so-called, as I like to call it, mangled care, which most people refer to as managed care, which to me falls under the rubric of pigs to the public hog trough. And I apologize if people find that offensive, but it's meant to be offensive because that's what I consider all this crap to be, frankly, which is why I don't do it. If you've ever wondered, by the way, why certain physicians and chiropractors and psychiatrists and psychologists and dental folks and all that kind of stuff don't take, some take managed care and some don't. The reason they don't is because they want to pay you a half to two-thirds of what you're actually worth, and then they want to, you know, make you a special, quote-unquote, preferred provider on their special provider list. Not to mention the fact you have to do a ton of paperwork and beg them for sessions, and the fact that they try to tell you how to practice your field by telling you what they will and will not reimburse for it. And while they certainly don't say, well, you can't, we can't tell you not to do that, they just won't pay you, and you can't bill the person that's under their special plan if you're one of their in-network providers. And since I didn't go to school for 15 years to have some son of a biscuit eater tell me how to practice psychology, obviously, or do my addictions work or whatever, obviously I told those people to go pound sand. So that's why I'm not on anybody's preferred provider in network mangled care panels, and why I don't do any of that stuff, or Medicare, Medicaid, or any of that crap, because I didn't want somebody else telling me what I could and could not do, and what I could bill for and what I could not bill for. So in case any of you are wondering why certain folks do and certain folks don't, it's not because they're trying to be difficult. It's because they don't want to come under Big Brother is watching, and they don't want some other third-party person telling them how to practice their field, where whether their field is dietary stuff or orthodontists, or excuse me, orthodontists folks, or chiropractors or whatever, and I don't blame them. So at any rate, in I think it's 2014, it might even be 2013, in order to do insurance reimbursement, they're going to want you to do the ICD codes, which is the international codes that's been used in other countries around the world for a long, long, long time. And so in this country, we use the DSM, and when you report diagnoses, they're done in DSM terminology, although, as I said, there's been a push to move to the ICD codes, at least for insurance reimbursement purposes. So who knows where the heck that's going to go. And to quote a line from a famous movie, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. So that's kind of how that goes. At any rate, I'm sure most of you could have done without me pontificating my political and diagnostic classification views, but I thought I'd throw that in for you just in case any of you wondered why some clinicians, physicians, and nutritionists and that sort of thing do take certain insurances and don't take others. And that's why, because they're smart and they don't want somebody else telling them how to do their job, and I don't blame them. It's like I tell most of my people, you know, I don't know dog squat about cars. I'm a complete moron when it comes to cars. And I take my car into my auto mechanic that I've been using for 20 years. And he's a super great guy. And everybody that works out of his establishment is really just very down to earth, no nonsense. And I don't go in there and tell him how to do my car. And, you know, they don't tell me how to practice what I do. And I take the car in and say, thank you very much, pay them their, my, whatever they charge me. And they always do a great job on my car. And I'm extremely grateful for that. And I don't expect them to do anything different for me or not do something because somebody said they could or couldn't. So, you know, I don't question them. I just pay them the money and say, thank you very much. And they always do a fabulous job. So kudos to them. So back to the original topic, which is the substance use and abuse disorders. I talked about last time about abuse versus use versus dependency. And sort of the cutting edge criteria, the social heuristic, the rule of thumb that I use with people when I talk about use and abuse, because a lot of people, as I mentioned last time, the DSM is very clear about what constitutes abuse and what constitutes dependency. And as I stated in the previous podcast, it's a whole heck of a lot harder to diagnose someone with a substance dependency disorder than it is a substance abuse disorder. In fact, I suspect that quite a number of our population at one time or another could probably be accused of being a substance abuser, because you only need one of the criteria over within a year period to be classified as such. So it's a whole lot easier to say you're a substance abuser than it is you're a substance-dependent person. But as I mentioned earlier in my previous podcast, a lot of folks will say, well, you know, how do you go between that slippery slope between use and abuse? Because obviously, you know, there's a point where abuse no longer becomes use no longer becomes use, it goes into abuse, and now it's deleterious for your health. And sort of the cutting edge, you know, criteria I use is, you know, if you're somebody who uses socially once in a blue moon sort of thing, or you use socially even once a month on a regular basis, and you do it, you know, let's say your drug of choice is marijuana. And again, I'm not, you know, encouraging anybody to do any of this stuff, because you're talking to a nerd who's never done drugs ever except coffee and tea and an occasional cigar, you know, and an occasional mixed drink, and never been drunk and any of that stuff because I'm a control freak. And as I said, that feeds into my obsessive compulsive personality disorder pathology, but that's for another podcast. But if you're a user and you do it at home and you're not driving under the influence and you're not doing a whole boatload of it and you're doing it once in a while as a social kind of thing, you know, you certainly qualify as a user. Where you cross into the abuse category is, you know, when you're using it because you have other psychological disorders, let's say depression or ADHD or whatever, and you're using that instead of your methylphenidate, your Ritalin for your ADHD, or you're using it, you know, in addition to eating poorly. And let's not forget, as I mentioned last time, according to the body, anything you put into the body that gets chemically decomposed into a compound is technically classified pharmacologically as a quote-unquote drug. So under that definition, water is a drug, okay? So what we're talking about are quote-unquote good drugs versus bad drugs. And so if you're doing pot, you know, and you have ADHD, that's a bad idea from day one, okay? But if you're going to want to be an occasional user and be kind of dumb once in a while, okay, fine. But if you're doing it and it's impacting your works, you're impacting your social, you know, situation in a negative kind of way, it's impacting your grades or your memory or whatever, you've just crossed the line from use to abuse, because it's sort of a hallmark of abuse is it's causing you deleterious effects in your life. You know it, and you're using it anyway, or you're obnoxiously denying it when it's like obvious to everybody and their brothers, sisters, second cousins, mules, aunts, dog, that, you know, you don't even know your own name, and you've got three DUIs, or your grades have slipped from A's to C's, and you're like, oh, no big deal, or whatever. Bad idea. Okay. So that's sort of my cutting edge thing. Is it causing you some kind of semi ongoing to, oh my God, ongoing problems in your life, whether it's DUIs, whether it's grade slipping, whether it's not showing up for work or showing up for work with a hangover so that you do really crappy jobs. So when you're building those engines at Lockheed, the planes are blowing up on on takeoff, right? Or the engines are starting to smoke or whatever, right? Obviously, that's bad, okay? To quote one of my favorite characters, if you've heard me do on these podcasts many times before, and I will probably continue to do them. So that's sort of the cutting edge. And you know, once you go from use to abuse, that's when your ears need to sort of perk up and you need to sort of kind of grab yourself by the short hairs and go, okay, what the heck am I doing here? And kind of get a lid on your id before you go from the abuse category to the dependency category, at which point you would meet the DSM criteria for dependency, which I went over last time. I'm not going to reiterate them again. And at that point, it becomes, you know, harder to stop doing. Obviously, like any of these things, the longer you get it, let it go, the harder it is to stop. And, you know, that it's kind of like a cancer, and I tell everybody that, you know, the longer you practice doing something, the better at it you get. So if you practice taking drugs for a long enough period of time, you get real good at it, and then it becomes hard not to do it. So it becomes sort of this habit thing. And as I think I've said before, probably on my first podcast, you know, one of my favorite characters, the famous Roman orator Cicero, once said, nothing is stronger than a tradition. And if he were a behaviorist, what he would say is, what you practice, you get really good at, which is essentially what he's saying. And my take on that is, what you get good at becomes habitual. And then what becomes habitual becomes a bitch to stop doing. Yeah, I know my jokes never get any better, but what can I say, okay? This is why I'm not a stand-up comedian, because I'd be broke. So the longer you practice doing something, even if it's bad for you, the better at it you get. So the earlier in this chain of events you can stop yourself, obviously the easier it is. That's also, by the way, one reason why I really like working with young people. I really like working with adolescents and young adults. They're a whole lot easier to work with in general than middle adults and older adults. And while I certainly don't have anything against middle adults or older adults, and I certainly work with them, it's easier to work with teenagers, even if they have a plethora of disorders, which most of mine do, or young adults, because they've just had a whole lot longer, to practice being foobarred. So, you know, a lot of my colleagues will go, "Oh my God, I can't believe you're working with this chronic disordered, drug addicted, you know, law breaking, you know, whatever, you know, kids, and you must be a masochist." And I just laugh and go, "No, I'm lazy." And my colleagues look at me and go, "Lazy? What the heck are you talking about?" And I go, "Well, you know, here's the deal. You know, you got a 50-year-old alcoholic, let's say, right, and you got a 25-year-old alcoholic. Okay, now what's the age at which most people, statistically speaking, get into the mindset and into the habit, if they're going to become substance dependent, if they're going to become quote-unquote addicts, what's the mean age that they get, you know, into the system, so to speak, internally and sometimes externally as well?" Well, the answer is 14 and a half, okay, statistically speaking. Let's just say 15 because I'm lazy and I want to get the math easy. Okay. So you got a 25-year-old and you got a 50-year-old. The 25-year-old has had 10 years to practice being an alcoholic, okay, or substance dependent or a severe abuser or whatever. You got the 50-year-old who's had a whole lot longer to practice, right? That person has had 35 years to practice. They're really, 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 really good at being an alcoholic. Who do you think's going to be the easier guy or gal to deal with? The person that's had 10 years to practice or the person that's had 35 years to practice? Let me think. Right. As I said, I'm lazy, okay? The 25-year-old is a whole lot easier to change once you get over the initial, you know, harumps and the initial, "No, you can't make me change, oh my God," you know, and all the defensiveness that people put up and the, you know, the bravado that some of my folks put on. And, you know, and part of that's because, let's face it, you know, most people in my business have not had a lot of training working with adolescents and young adults. But, you know, and typically in grad schools, they're, you know, adolescents are lumped with either children and they're infantilized like crazy, or they're lumped with adults and we expect them to do everything we say and shake their head and go, you know, "Yes, that's right, doctor, I'll do everything you say." And yeah, like that's going to happen, right? I mean, even the adults hardly anymore don't do that unless you get somebody who's really old school. So the whole deal is a lot of these people come in and, you know, they've had some pretty bad experiences with folks in my profession or related professions. And they either expect us to, you know, shake our fingers and go, now, you know, and do everything we say and, you know, bow three times before they leave the room kind of thing. Or we over-infantilize them and go, "It's a wonderful day in the neighborhood. Would you like us, lollipop? I knew you good," right? And let's face it, who the heck wants to be treated like a three-year-old, okay? Unless you're a three-year-old. And I don't see three-year-olds. So, you know, no wonder some of these guys and gals that come in to see me are a little shell-shocked and a little so-called quote-unquote defensive, right? Or they've dealt with adults who are very castigatory or very negative or very narrow-minded or whatever, and they've gotten the party line and they do what I say, yada-yada, whatever. So for whatever reason, folks come in, and I'm usually, you know, therapist number 5 or 6 down the line for most of the folks that see me. Because let's face it, most of them's parents have been stupid and taken them to one of these mangled care therapists, as I call them. You know, and, you know, if you've got some real easy thing to go to deal with, if you've got, you know, garden variety depression or you've got some dysthymic disorder, which is a mild form of depression, I call it wimpy, wimpy, wimpy depression, and I'm not minimizing it because it's, you know, it's not an easy thing to do, but it's a low-level depression that doesn't quite meet the depression criteria in a sense. So if you're one of those folks, or you've got a mild case of anxiety, you know, or you're in, you know, a mild bereavement scenario, you know, your pet animal that you've had for 8 years has died, and you're, you know, kind of in mourning or whatever, or you've relocated, you know, to Fairbanks, Alaska from, you know, New York, and you're having adjustment problems because there's no nightlife and there's no Follies, you know, and there's no Madison Square Garden or whatever, and you're having shell shock. Okay, yeah, I mean, anybody with a degree and a brain can do that. And if that's the case, fine. But most of the folks I see aren't that easy to deal with. They have a multiplicity of things going on. And most of these folks that, you know, are in the managed care scenario just frankly don't have the chutzpah and whatever it is. And they don't have the sessions because the managed care company doesn't give it to them. And they can't do testing and they can't do any of this other stuff. So they have to go and report. They can, you know, most of these mangled care companies won't allow you to do testing. They won't pay for it. They'll allow you to do it, but they just won't pay you for it. So nobody's going to work for free. And I don't blame them. So basically, you're having to go on the person's report. And how do you know the person isn't lying to you? How do you know the person knows what's really going on then? Because it's not uncommon that somebody will come in and say, oh, I have a drinking problem. And you go, aha, they're an alcoholic. Well, yeah, maybe they do meet the criteria for substance dependency. And maybe they meet the criteria for alcohol dependency. And so they're a quote-unquote alcoholic. But why are they an alcoholic? Right? They're not an alcoholic because they're an alcoholic. That's circular reasoning. That's ridiculous. You know, that's like the disease model. Well, he's an alcoholic because he has a disease. Well, how does he have disease? Because he's an alcoholic. Oh, he was born with it. Oh, yeah, right. Uh-huh. I've got a bridge in the Sahara I'll sell you too if you really believe that crap, okay? People become drug addicts and substance abusers. And if you remember in the last time I said I don't segregate alcohol and drugs, I don't go alcohol and other drugs are all drugs, so I just call them all the same thing. It's the same thing if you're a religious addict. You know, your drug is Jesus or your drug is Allah or Buddha or whatever. You're still an addict, okay? It's all the same as far as I'm concerned, whether it's food, shopping, religion, whatever. So it's circular reasoning to say, well, you take drugs because you're an addict. Well, why are you an addict? Because you take drugs and because you have a disease. It's like, oh, please, right? People are substance abusers and substance dependent because they're trying to medicate themselves from something, okay? In the initial, you know, first etiological reason why they're using these drugs is because they're trying to medicate themselves from something, whether it's low self-esteem, whether it's low self-efficacy, whether it's depression, ADHD, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, schizophrenia, what the heck ever, okay? They're medicating themselves. And what happens is, the Doobie Brothers had an old record title called Those Which Were Once Vices Are Now Habits, right? And that's what happens. These things start out being a vice, a quote-unquote coping tool, and they end up morphing into a disorder, right? By the way, you'll never hear me call addictions diseases. They're not diseases, never were diseases, and I alluded to this in the last podcast, and I'm really going to hit it hard this podcast because I want you to get that name and that term out of your vocabulary totally and completely, right? Now, I know everywhere you go, most of the hospitals and the vast majority of therapists and clinicians and addictions counselors all use the term disease, and you see the 12 steps as based on this disease model and all this kind of crap, and you see this television ads. Well, don't believe it. Okay, it's a myth perpetrated on the public. Why has it been perpetrated? Well, there's probably a myriad of reasons, and I alluded to this in the last podcast, but I'll say it bluntly now. I personally think it's because Americans, and by the way, the 12 steps is a purely American invention. We're one of the few countries on the planet that believes this crap, okay? Because we as Americans like somebody to blame for our stuff. Oh, I have a disease, okay? Oh, I want God to take it from me, or I want whatever. Well, yeah, oh, don't even go there, okay? That flies in the face of every sound psychological principle on the flippin' planet, okay? Because you're going to feign helplessness. You're not helpless. You gave up your control. You gave it up willingly when you started using the daggum drug. Because even if you buy the disease model doesn't say you have to use. It says you can't stop once you start, and you can't go back once you cross the line between abuse and dependency. We also know that's erroneous because there have been plenty of studies that show that a pretty good portion, I think it's either 43 or 47%, I forget the exact number now, but it's a pretty big percent of the population who can go back across the line, once they've been diagnosed as substance dependent and use drugs recreationally and never become addicted again. However, and I've said this the last podcast and I want to reiterate it again, I tell everybody it's like having optional surgery, right? If you had the choice to do optional surgery, you're going to have a cosmetic nose job, and the surgeon says, hey, I can make you look like the best looking guy or gal on the planet. You're going to come out of this surgery, you know, there's a 43 or 47% chance you're going to look like the god or a goddess. The bad news is there's a 53 or whatever percent chance you're going to die on the operating table, okay? Now, let's be honest, folks. Are you going to go in for the optional surgery? Not if you have a brain in your head. And that's the same thing I tell every person who's been diagnosed substance dependent. It ain't worth it. It's not worth the risk. Because how do you know you're in that percentage that can go back? You don't. And if you have one of the major disorder, other psychological disorders that are frequently comorbid, that means they exist together. I call it polymorbid, from the Greek poi, meaning many, because I never see anybody that's just got one thing. They've got substance abuse dependency and usually have several of them. And then they have a boatload of other disorders on top. So it's not comorbid, it's polymorbid, right? And there's a joke journal, by the way, I don't know if it's still being published or not, in our field called the Journal of Polymorphous Perversity, which I just thought was hilarious. It used to have all these great joke articles in there. It was just really funny. And so I call this polymorphous perversity, and that's the kind of folks I see. So if you're in one of those groups, if you have ADHD, if you have bipolar disorder, if you have schizophrenia, if you have borderline personality disorder, you know, if you have major depression, if you have anxiety disorders, if you have more than one substance dependency disorder, or if you have a substance dependency and multiple substance abuse disorders, right, do yourself a favor. Don't have the optional surgery. Your chances are not great, okay? Abstinence is your best bet. And I'll say it again. Abstinence is your best bet, right? And you don't have to believe in a disease model. All you have to do is look at reality. Look at the data. It's very, very, very clear. Just like the data is very, very, very clear that they're not diseases. They never have been diseases. They never will be diseases, okay? And I'll tell you the story now. So back in the late 80s, there was a person who got admitted a boatload of times, we're talking like 27 times, to the VA system, which runs on a disease model, by the way. And the guy went to get back in for his like 28th, stay at the VA. And this is common for the VA. The VA has a, you know, having worked there, I can tell you the VA is a revolving door population. They have a lot of folks that frequent their services repeatedly, particularly in the substance abuse and dependency wards. They have ongoing issues and they just keep coming back. Okay, so this guy had been back something like 27, 28 times, and I'm not joking. There was a guy that was there in the ward when I was there that had been in there. He was like 50 something. He'd been in the VA like 28 or 29 times. I mean, it was ridiculous. You know, it's like the patients in the ward used to say, this guy just wants three hots and a cot. I mean, he's not serious about getting better. He wouldn't be there for 28 times. I mean, give me a break, okay? Anyway. So this guy comes in and petitions the VA to take him back in. The VA says, look, you're not serious. You've been here too many daggum times. We're not taking you back. We're keeping the bed open for somebody who really wants help. And the guy says, you know, you can't do that. I have a disease. You have to take me back. I can't help. And the VA says, screw you. We're not taking you back. So he sues the VA. This thing goes all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And at the time, the Supreme Court commissioned guys in California, researchers. I think they were at Stanford, but don't quote me on this. And they were not addictionologists, they were not physicians in the sense, they were not therapists or psychiatrists. These guys were researchers and statisticians, and that's what they did ad nauseum. So the judge says, I want you to investigate all the research data over the last 30, 40, whatever years, and come up with a decision, are addictions diseases in your opinion or not, statistically speaking? And guess what they found? That's right, boys and girls, men and women, they ain't diseases. They're a choice. Period. End of story. And if you don't believe me, go get the book, because they published a book based on their findings. The book is called Heavy Drinking, The Myth of Alcoholism as a Disease. It's by Herbert Fingeret. Okay, it's a great book, and all the AA and the 12-step people hate that book for obvious reasons, right? And even despite the fact that book's published, what's the vast majority treatment models that the USA uses? That's right. We still use the disease model because we want to bill insurance for stuff and we want somebody else to blame for our stuff, okay? And they basically said it's not a disease, never has been, okay? Now, I'm not suggesting it's not a disorder. I'm not suggesting it's not a problem. I'm not suggesting it's not a serious problem. I'm suggesting it's not a disease. In fact, if you look in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, notice the term disorders, you will not see the word disease attached to anything in that book, including substance disorders. Not one flipping time. Ever. Okay? And that's the diagnostic manual. They ain't diseases, friends. They just aren't. You don't like it? I'm sorry. They're not. Okay? Face reality. Okay? I don't believe in Santa Claus anymore either. Okay? Great concept, but come on. So, that being the case, what often happens is it's a habitual thing. So, once you get it, once you make the choice to start using, right? And does the genetic predisposition, do you have a likelihood, an increased likelihood of using substances if you have a history of that in your family, genetically speaking? Well, absolutely. But you also have a genetic loading for lots of stuff that doesn't necessarily manifest into the disorder, right? It's a combination of do you have the loading, do you have the self-esteem, self-efficacy, do you have the so-called resiliency factor, and what does the environment, you know, hold for you, because that also plays a factor, right? I mean, addictions run on both sides of my family, okay? I can trace many, many, many people on both my father and my mother's side of the family who are drug abusers and substance addicts. I mean, without question. And given that knowledge, despite the fact that I was a sick and fat kid, and nobody, trust me, friends and neighbors, nobody had less self-esteem as a kid than I did. None, zip, zero, the empty set, okay? But I knew that if I ever started using that crap, that no matter how good I felt in the minute, you know, in the long run, I was going to create another problem for myself. I saw it in my family members. I saw it in some of the buddies I knew. And I'm a good observational learner, right? And I looked on both sides of my family and went, are we having fun yet? No thanks. I gave it the office. And that's why I never started. And nobody had lower self-esteem than I did as a kid. Nobody had more opportunity to use drugs as a kid. I've been a musician since I was 10 years old. You think I haven't been around drugs before, okay? I mean, please. So don't give me that, oh, well, I'm a musician. Of course I'm around drugs. Yeah, right. Tell me another one I won't believe, right? Both of my parents drink. They're both addicts. Addictions run in my family. Yeah, give me another story I won't believe. Little Red Riding Hood? Oh, please. Okay? Look, you made a choice. You made a dumb choice. We all make dumb choices. I'm not slamming anybody. Please don't mishear me. I am not making fun of people who have a substance use or addiction problem. I'm really, 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 really not. I feel bad for those folks, but it's not a disease. Take responsibility for it. You made the choice to use. You're responsible. That gives you a ton of power. Now, notice I didn't say blame, okay? I don't say blame and fault and guilt. Why do I not say those things? Because they're useless emotions. Useless. The only damn things those things will do is make you feel bad. And you know what happens when you feel bad? That's right. You go to your coping tool, quote unquote, which for most addictions folks are drugs or shopping or sexing or whatever. Bad idea. So I don't ever use those terms. I don't use them with the folks I work with. I don't ever use it. I don't ever say you're to blame, it's your fault. I say it's your responsibility. There's a big difference in those words because fault, guilt, blame, shame, all of those words lay this horrible emotional trip on people. And they don't need that crap. Nobody needs that crap. That's not going to change a damn thing. Feeling bad is not going to change anything, right? Being responsible means you're the author of it. That means if you're the author of it, you can change it. Yet gives you power. You're not powerless. That's ridiculous. Don't give your power away. You have control. You have the power. You have the power to not use. You have the power to do something else. But you got to know you have the power. Somebody's got to tell you that, okay? You got to be educated how to do it. This is not done by osmosis, by watching reruns of, you know, some sitcom on TV. You're not going to figure out how to run your life. And let's face it, We as a society do a crappy job in teaching parents how to parent. We do a crappy job at teaching people how to say no to drugs. Just say no. Yeah, right. Okay. There's another myth I'll believe. You know, I mean, yeah, it's a great idea and concept, but when you've got a bunch of emotional problems and you don't have abstract reasoning and yada, 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 that stuff becomes very, very difficult to do, right? So you need help how to do it, right? You need help how to say no. You need help to choose alternative stuff. That's where people like me comes in, right? And if we did a better job in our society of teaching kids how to resist pressure and say no and do alternatives and feel better about ourselves and stop using blame and shame and guilt and all this crap, maybe we wouldn't have all these problems. But we do, and you know, that's fantasy too. We need to face reality for what it is. So take back your power. Don't blame yourself, but hold yourself responsible, because the reality is you are responsible. It's not your parents' fault. It's not God's fault. It's not society's fault. It's not even your fault, but it is your responsibility. It's not society's responsibility. It's not God's responsibility. It's not your parents' responsibility. It's not the school's responsibility. It's not your boss's or your wife or your boyfriend or girlfriend. It's yours. Own it. Take it. Because once you take it, you can do any daggum thing you want with it. You are in control. You have the power. Use that power to choose something different for yourself. Choose not to use. That's the mantra I tell people. Choose not to use. Short-term gains, and I use the term gains in quotes, because using drugs is a short-term gain solution. It's I'm going to feel better right here in the immediate gratification right here and right now for long-term pains. It's going to bite you in the butt sooner or later, in one way or another, right? And I tell people, I collect guitars and basses. I've been a musician since I was 10. And part of the reason I don't use drugs is because I've been a musician, because it gets in the way of my channeling God. And I don't say that jokingly, because that's what I do when I play guitar. I channel God, the prime mover, you know, the force, whatever you want to call it. But I'm channeling spirituality stuff when I'm playing. And I don't want anything coming between me and my God. Not a zip zero the empty set. That's just a dumber than dog poop. Okay, so I don't do it. And so I can never figure out why great musicians would want anything to come between them and their channel and their art, because they're great and why they don't need it, right? Obviously, they don't believe that, or they wouldn't do that crap. But that's why I never did it. And besides, here's the other mantra I used, right? People come in and people who know me, you know, who come to my house, see all my babies. That's what one of my musical friends calls my guitars and basses and sitars and whatever, my quote-unquote babies. The same person called me on Father's Day, which I thought was really cute, and went, "Happy Father's Day!" And I went, "Oh my God, please don't tell me I have a kid running around somewhere going, hey, remember me? You know, Grateful Dead concert, 1988, you know, Cornfield with Susie May? No, wasn't me. Wasn't there." You know, this person goes, no. You have 90 or 100 of those babies. I don't know how many you have, and I don't know how many I have either. That, you know, here's my standing joke. How do you know you have too many musical instruments? Answer: when you don't know how many you have, okay? So the person goes, "Oh, all those babies you have sitting around your house." And I just started laughing. I'm like, "Oh, by the Lord, that is too funny." But anyway, if you're spending money on drugs or alcohol or, you know, porn or whatever, you don't have money to spend on babies. And let's face it, I like nice babies. And them things are pricey, okay? You don't get nice babies for nothing, right? As Neil Peart writes and Geddy Lee sings, you don't get something for nothing. You don't get freedom for free. You don't get wise with the sleep still in your eyes, no matter what your dream might be. Okay? So if your dream is to collect nice babies, you ain't getting them by pissing your money away, excuse my rudeness, on cigarettes, which are a drug. Let's never forget that. They're the most lethal drug in America. I said that on the last podcast. I'll say it again. They're the most lethal drug in America. They kill 3 times the number of people than all other drugs combined, and that includes alcohol. So what's the most dangerous drug in America, kiddies? That's right, cigarettes. And I tell every parent that. So if you're a cigarette smoker, you're a drug addict, don't be looking at your kid saying, "Why are you using drugs?" Because you're using drugs too, and you're being a bad role model. Stop using drugs yourself and give your kid a break, and show your kid that you will take in your power back, become a good role model for your kid. This you know, stuff of do as I say, not as I do never did work, and it sure as heck doesn't work nowadays. Okay, and that's why I can tell people don't do drugs, because I don't And I can say that quite nicely. You know, do I use alcohol occasionally? Yes. So do I do drugs on occasion? Yes. I don't tell people not to drink on occasion. I don't tell people not to smoke cigars on rare occasions, right? I don't tell people to become cigarette smokers. I don't tell people to smoke cigarettes or cigars or pipes or anything else every day. I don't tell them to even do it once a week, right? It's just, you are in charge of this, but you've got to take the power back. You've got to believe that you take the power back. You've got to believe that you have the power. If you don't believe it, you ain't going to do it. Because one of my major mentors many years ago, and today it gone bad, I didn't listen to him sooner, but I was too young and stupid and full of myself and a bunch of other stuff I shouldn't have been full of. young angst and testosterone and a variety of other things. You know, full of bull is more like it. But anyway, back in the day, this person said to me, as you believe, so shall you do. And he was right. And that sounds really simple, but that is an incredibly profound statement, because what it really means is, as you believe, that's how you're going to feel about life, yourself, whatever. And then that's what's going to cause you to do or not do something. So as you believe, so shall you feel. And as you feel, so shall you do. And that is true about everything. Whether it's winning a baseball game, whether it's playing guitar, or whether it's stop quitting drugs or stop quitting. That's a double. That doesn't make any sense. Let me say that again. Stop using drugs or not even starting drugs or whatever. Not hitting your wife, not yelling and screaming at the kids, not beating your dog. I mean, whatever, right? You are in charge of that. As you believe, so shall you feel and so shall you do. If you don't get anything else out of any of these podcasts, remember that, because you are the power. You and you alone. Can you ask God, Allah, the Prime Mover, or whatever for help? Oh, absolutely. And if you've got a spiritual system you use and you want to help, you know, give yourself a booster by, you know, channeling God or whatever, oh, heck yeah. Right? But give God some help. Get off your butt and start doing it yourself. Start opening the channel for God to work through, okay? If that's your shtick, open the channel and start enacting it. Start doing it. One of my Christian counseling friends used to call it giving your prayers wings, and I just love that. I thought that was so cool. You know, just, you've got to take the power back, right? So remember, you can do it, right? It's hard work, but so is learning to be a great guitar player. So is learning to be a great dad. So is learning to be a great student or a great opera singer or a great anything. You don't get wise with the sleep still in your eyes. You don't get wise sitting on your butt, stuffing your mouth with potato chips, hoping to lose weight. Ain't gonna happen. Okay? So take the power back. It is in your ability to do. Okay? And in the next couple of podcasts, I'm gonna talk about how to do that. And I'm gonna talk about how, despite the fact that you know, statistically speaking, if you have a substance problem, it's not uncommon that you have other things going on, whether it's depression, anxiety, or whatever, and I'm going to talk about some of that and what to do if you have those kind of so-called comorbid or coexisting conditions, which only recently has the addiction field even acknowledged or even allowed people to take medication for if they really need it. You know, and I'm certainly not a medication advocate, so please don't mishear me, but there are certain conditions that it's just really dumb if you don't give, you know, biochemistry a little help here. Right, nature foobard, you need to give nature a little help, because sometimes people are just born with, you know, biochemically challenged brains through no fault of their own, and that's just the way it is, okay? And you got to give nature a little help here sometimes, okay? But you can also change your biochemistry by how you think, because think about what thinking is, right? Every thought is an electrical impulse, which means you're having a chemical, an electrical, and a magnetic charge. To have, how do you have a thought? You have an electrical impulse over a synapse, because nerves don't touch. There's this little space between nerve cells called synapses that has to do with biochemistry. So if you change how you think, you change heart rates, you change neural pathways, you do it over a long period of time, you create new pathways. So if you start thinking in an angry kind of way, you're going to become an angry person, because you're going to train your brain, right? Remember, nothing is stronger than tradition. Remember the Cicero thing, right? As you believe, so shall you do, so shall you feel. You're going to train your brain. You're going to change your biochemistry. You're going to change your neural pathways. That is powerful stuff. You have the power to do that simply by changing your belief systems, changing what you say to yourself and how you look at yourself and how you look at the rest of the world. This is powerful stuff, people. I honest to God, I cannot say this enough. I cannot emphasize this enough. I can't preach it enough. Nothing is more important. Take charge of your own thoughts. Take charge of your life. Take the power back. You can do it. Any flipping body on the planet, just about, is capable to do this. You don't have to be a genius to do this. This does not require 130 IQ, okay? It really does not. So I hope that's a good start, and in the next podcast, we'll pick up where we left off. As always, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it.